Are we in the podcast now?
Oh, I don't know. How do we begin this again? Like, how do we start this?
We start this with the opening lines.
Oh, let's hear the opening lines from this here book.
Yeah.
I'm curious as to whoever will record this, how they're going to read the first word of this book. Because I'll tell you one thing, Stockard Channing makes a choice and it don't work.
Yeep, sang Ramona Quimby one warm September afternoon as she knelt on a chair at the kitchen table to make out her Christmas list. She had enjoyed a good day in second grade, and she looked forward to working on her list. For Ramona, a Christmas list was a list of presents she hoped to receive, not presents she planned to give. Yeep, she sang again. Thank goodness today is payday, remarked Mrs. Quimby, as she opened the refrigerator to see what she could find for supper.
Well, you know, we were discussing, strangely enough, we were discussing Walt Whitman right before we began recording. And I have to say, when Ramona opens with her yeep, it always reminds me of Walt Whitman's barbaric yawp.
Yes, which our listeners might know better from the movie that made the barbaric yawp a thing, the poem boys poetry
those dead poem boys,
the dead poet society. That was where they talked about that in that, right?
I think so. It's been a while since I saw that.
Yes, the barbaric yawp, which is kind of what we start this book with, Ramona Quimby's own variation of singing a joyful noise unto the Lord.
Well, until the Lord.
Until the Lord, right. So this book, Ramona and her father, this is the next, I was going to say this is the next on our list, but obviously it is the next on our list. It's the next in the Ramona, like, canon. It is the next Beverly Cleary book. This is her continuing just her rapid fire. Here come the Ramona books, and that's kind of how I'm going to be defined from the 70s on, is right. The Ramona author.
Yeah, this is from 1977, and rereading it this time, I was struck by, you know, first of all, how excellent these books are, but also how, as you've pointed out, these four books in a row just really are one narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought that this book ended with the way I believe the next books ended, the next book ends. So I'm conflating events from these books because they are so closely related in my head.
Yeah, they pick up one right after the other. This is also an interesting book in that she's gone to a new grade in this book, but they haven't made a big deal out of it at all.
Right.
She has a new teacher who is barely a character, and you're sort of lending like credence to the idea that Ramona's kind of moving past that phase in her life where her teacher's opinion of her is everything.
Yeah. Now, I want to like back up and give a little bit of my own history with this book. This was not a book I read when it came out. This came out in 1977.
Mm-hmm.
And 1977, of course, was the year of Star Wars. It was the year that I moved from Youngstown, Ohio to Eureka, Illinois. I was aware of this book.
Right.
And when it came out, but I didn't read it. And I'm going to tell you something that I hope does not shock you.
Okay.
Because when I was a kid, I had a really hard time with books that I saw as message books.
Okay. Right?
Like a book that was a problem that the main character was working through. And this book was going to be given to a child as a way of working through perhaps your own difficult situation. You know, there
yeah.
were lots of these books like that, like kids dealing with the death of a parent or the death of a pet, or what do you do with, for example, too much bullying or
yeah.
too much candy.
Yes.
Those kinds of books. And somehow I got it in my head that I just didn't like that as a conceit. I thought
yeah.
that was pat, and I and you know, one of these days I will be on your podcast and we will discuss this further, but I loved the old Berenstain Bears picture books, never read the first time books.
Yes.
But So I didn't read this book until I was an adult reading it to my own children. And I was reading it at a time that I was going through my own period of unemployment, having been laid off from a dot-com that didn't really have its act together. Not that many dot-coms had their acts together. And, oh my God, this was a very brutal book to be reading at that time in my life.
Now, as a kid, were you given the impression that this was a message book? Like,
well, I knew that this was a book about that dealt with the unemployment.
Oh,
of
I see.
The father.
Yeah.
And I don't know where I got that information. I think maybe it was just like I read it on the side, you know, the flap of the book or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
And I figured, oh, this is going to just be like a book that's going to tell you kids, you know, oh, this is a tough time, but you'll pull through, and here's what you got to do.
Nope. It is. Boy, does it go in a different direction from that.
Exactly. And I'm just saying that by way of saying an apology to Mrs. Clary. As is usually the case, a much deeper, much more subtle book than I might have given it credit for.
Well, it's funny because I mean, obviously I didn't read this book when it first came out. I was 1 year old, and I was aware of this book as having read the first few Ramona books, like starting with Beezus and Ramona the Pest. I was aware of this book kind of being the beginning of Ramona's hard knock life. And it intimidated me away from Ramona and her father and Ramona and her mother, because I knew that this is where the character, it was just very clear, maybe from the book jacket itself, that this is where things really started getting tough for the Quimbys. And having reread this, I mean, I've read this book a million times now, but I believe I skipped these books and went straight to Ramona Forever, and then realized I was missing a lot of context, and then went back and read these books like right away, because these books dealt with hardship, and I was not really looking for that as a kid. I wanted a little more escapism, and when I finally went back and read these books, and when I say finally, it was probably like a month later, but when I went back and read these books, really appreciated that you kind of had to work through this hard time to get to the satisfaction in the books later on. I mean, this book ends on a bit of an up note, but it's a tempered up note. The family pulls through, but you know, like, it's more of like good times maybe ahead. You know, like, not all of your problems certainly aren't over at the end of this book.
Yeah. I can't help myself from doing this, I also was thinking about the 1970s. And this book, of course, is being written in the midst of stagflation. This is being written in the midst of the long decay of the 1970s. You know, we'd had all kinds of problems in the early 70s, starting with Nixon's price freeze in 71 to try and combat inflation, and then we had the OPEC oil embargo of 74. Or was it 73? I can't remember. Anyway, it was in the early 70s. And so this was really what marked the end of the golden years of the baby boom. You know, everyone was thinking the economy was just going to get better and better, and it had been getting better and better through the 50s and the 60s. And unions were strong, and it was very easy to have one breadwinner in a family and not have to think about anything. And so as a country, what goes on with the Quimbys was certainly happening everywhere at this time.
And we get, so just for our listeners who aren't familiar with the book, the basic rundown of this one is, at the beginning of the story, Ramona's father comes home and basically he's lost his job because his company has been his little company has been bought by a big company who then let most of the people who work for the little company go. We don't get any more detail than that. But the course of this book is Ramona's father trying to find work and Ramona having to deal with her father on a more one-on-one basis because he's at home all the time now. But he's not the fun father she thought he would be because he's obviously very depressed. He's having trouble finding work. He kind of takes his problems out on the family a little bit. He's not a pleasant man to be around. Ramona and Beezus sort of take it upon themselves to pressure their father into quitting smoking because they are worried about his health. There's this long sequence where they kind of campaign to have him stop smoking. He ultimately agrees to, and he and Ramona kind of have a little heart to heart about where she sort of comes to realize that he's trying as hard as he can. His life is difficult. He sort of realizes the effect he's having on his family through a little breakdown that Ramona has. And then there's a little adventure at the end with a Christmas pageant that kind of is its own little book in the last two chapters. But kind of brings things full circle where he gets a new job. It's not a great job, but it's going to help pay the bills. And that's the end of the book. It's more about the relation, as the title says, it's more about Ramona and her father and their relationship than it is about any kind of incident. Like this is a book that's really about these people and less and less, as we're seeing from Beverly Cleary, about chapter long hijinks.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I agree with your, especially with your assessment of the last chapter as kind of being of a sort of a different character of the rest of the book. The last chapter feels more like one of Beverly Cleary's traditional stories.
It's telling that the last adventure, the story, it did appear in Family Circle magazine, like as a standalone story. Before this book was published.
But it does focus strongly on this relationship. And one might expect, the next book focuses strongly on the relationship with the mother.
Oh yes.
And it's quite interesting what the relationship is here. To draw back on my own experience of having been laid off and gone through a few months of trying to make it as a freelancer and failing utterly, it's a humiliating time in a man's life. And probably more so in the 70s when there still were strong gender expectations.
Right.
These books are interesting in the way that they deal with changing gender roles, because you get a feeling of being down there in the trenches. One of the things that happens in these books is Ramona's mother, as we know from the last book, has gone and gotten a job to help pay extra bills, but then she quickly switches over at the beginning of this book to working full time so that they can at least stop the bleeding, the economic bleeding of the family. And now they're in a place where the mother is the breadwinner, the father is trying to get a job, but he's also trying his best to help out domestically, although he's not necessarily very good at it.
Right. And I think this is where it really becomes, to me, fascinating, in the sense that although all the Ramona books take place within this continuum, they form a definite arc. You sort of follow this character year by year, because the initial Ramona books are spaced out by decades. You get to see Beverly Cleary dealing with the same characters in the same situation, but through the lens of the decade in which they were written. The early Ramona books were very much books set in the late 50s, then the 60s, and now this is, like, as you said, definitely the 70s. Like this story couldn't have happened if she had just written these books one after the other, starting when she did. She is exploring family and the same family dynamic, but what happens to this family? What happens to a family that was borderline a 1950s sitcom family when they're suddenly when they suddenly become a Norman Lear family that would be very comfortable in the world of All in the Family and Good Times and dealing with the socioeconomic happenings in the 1970s. We're suddenly going from a family that was used to dealing with cowboys and Indians to a family that's dealing with the oil crisis and, like you said, changing gender roles and gender expectations and mustachioed fathers giving up smoking. Like, that's that's what happens in this book. And I think it's a tribute to Beverly Cleary's, not only her her writing genius, but her ability to look at the world that is changing around her and incorporate that into her writing. It's why these books in this era start getting confused in a lot of people's minds with like Judy Blume books, because they start feeling a lot grittier and a lot more like realistic and reflecting what's not only happening incidentally to the people who are reading them, but also emotionally to the people who are reading them. Ramona's father is not he's not a model parent.
Right.
In this book, the kids' feelings get dismissed a lot by both the parents. Secrets are kept, and when they're revealed, you see that the parents are a little bit selfish in the way they deal with things. There's a lot of parents snapping at the children, and this is where we really see Beezus stop being the Beezus that we were used to. She gets kind of a little bit of an attitude, and she's a preteen now, and she's not having it with the way her parents are treating her and Ramona. It's handled very well, but it is also very uncomfortable to a reader.
Right. There's a In the second chapter of the book, after the loss of the father's job, the storyline starts as something that could have been in one of Cleary's earlier books. It's about Ramona getting into trouble because of her imagination. She finds a bunch of burrs while she's waiting for her father to, what was her father doing at that point?
A parent-teacher conference.
Okay, right, a parent-teacher conference, which is motivated because of, in part because she's been repeating commercial jingles, which we've seen before, but now it's no longer just wacky fun. It's actually kind of a difficult thing for her because she has insulted her teacher and she's worried about what's going to happen at this conference. But she finds these burrs growing from a bush by the side of the road, puts them, starts sticking them together as kids do, and as I'm sure anyone who's grown up in North America remembers a summer day doing that as a child, and sticks them in her hair. And then the story becomes, how are they going to get these out of her hair? And that all is just sort of crazy hijinks fun, except that the motivation for the father is he doesn't want to appear to be slacking on his job as caregiver when mom gets home.
Yeah.
And it becomes actually quite tense. He wants to figure out a way to get this out so that he can preserve the illusion of control, or at least of competence,
right,
as a father. And when mother shows up, it becomes a showdown between Ramona and the mother about who's going to cut these out of her hair. She chooses her father because in an interesting choice. She's aligning herself with her dad.
Yeah, and well, let's not forget the reason Ramona has been repeating commercial jingles is because her father told her that kids in commercials earn a lot of money, and that's so Ramona's basically practicing to be in commercials because she thinks she can save the family by making a lot of money being in commercials, which is also where I learned how kids get paid to be like, this is the book that taught me, oh, you film a commercial and you get paid every time it airs. Like, I didn't know that. Like, this is the book that taught me that. But what's interesting about what you said is that this is laying a lot of ground for the upcoming books as well. This is the first instance where we really see that Ramona has a different relationship with her father than she does with her mother. The parents aren't a unified force all the time. Father does things carefully. Mother gets impatient and will do things quickly. And Ramona doesn't want her hair cut to ribbons, so she asks that her father do it. And we also see that she trusts her father a bit more and feels closer to him in general, which is kind of what the next book is about, spoilers. But this is it's laying a lot of emotional groundwork. And what you said about, like, this could be just a wacky story, Ramona, with your thing. But it's grounded in that need that she has to save her family. And it's all tied into the roles these people play in each other's lives. Because when even Beezus comes in, and she's been cranky recently, we don't really know why, but it's because of adolescence. And Beezus offers her 2 cents as far as, like, the best way to get these burrs out of Ramona's hair. It becomes this family problem, but each family member is playing a different role emotionally.
When you were talking about Ramona's plan to make $1 million to save the family, it reminded me that when I was about Ramona's age, I desperately wanted to be on Zoom, the PBS show that's it's filmed here in Boston. I had no idea how these things worked.
You're
or
right.
How, you know, you when you're a kid, you just assume, oh, these kids must just go and work there, and I could go and work there.
Yeah.
You know? And there's this expectation. There's no sense of geography. There's no sense of what the barriers are to entry into an industry. You know, I really wanted to be on Zoom. I also had a book that I dearly loved called Good Sense, which was a book that was published in the 70s. It was called, subtitled, A Child's Guide to Making Money.
Yeah.
And it had all these, like, money-making schemes about how you were going to go off and sell, you know, these different craft projects you made. And I was convinced that this was my ticket to financial independence. And I think I tried a few of these things. But, you know, it was things like make macrame owls and sell them for $1 each, or go around to people's houses and ask for their recyclables and go.
It was basically how to be Henry Huggins.
Exactly. And it's, you know, there's a kind of a good lesson there, because you do learn that the only money you're going to make doing this sort of thing is the 50 cents your parents throw your way out of pity, you know?
Yeah. No, it is interesting, and it's also emotionally gripping that Ramona's parents don't spend a lot of time. You get this moment at the very first chapter. Ramona's mom says, "Don't do anything to annoy your father," and that's pretty much all the parents say to the girls. There's not a lot of hand-holding as far as the parents are concerned with helping their children understand what exactly is going on. How much danger are they in, like, to lose, like, their lives, like their house? The kids are just sort of, like, set loose. Like, your dad lost his job. Don't annoy him. And it's up to the girls to kind of navigate this landscape themselves. There's no sense that the parents ever said to each other, we have to make sure that the girls aren't going to worry too much, like, about this, or, like, think it's their responsibility to, like, none of that. Like, it's very much just like, your dad lost his job, stay out of his way, he's going to be around, stay off the phone, he may get a call for a job, keep out of the house, don't make too much noise. And that's a very, to me, 1970s approach. It's that sort of, like, hands-off parenting thing that we talk about every now and then, only this time, instead of, oh, kids, go have the run of the neighborhood, it's, oh, kids, we don't need to worry about your emotional well-being. The next few months are going to be fraught, but stay out of Dad's way. Let him smoke his cigarettes.
Right. I mean, yeah. One of the things that does come up in this book is the continuing confederacy between Ramona and Beezus. They have to band together and plot together in some cases here, particularly in regards to trying to get their dad to quit cigarettes. And that has been growing, I think, since the end of Beezus and Ramona. And it's nice to see moving along that the two of them turn to each other. By the end of this run of books, of course, they will really have to rely on each other, I think, much more than they do even in this book.
But it doesn't go so far as to make them allies in everything.
Right.
Because Beezus is still going through her like adolescent like emotional changes, and they tiptoe around that subject carefully, but she is easy to set off. And the chapter The Night of the Jack-O-Lantern introduces a couple of things into this book series that will come to a head in later books, which is Picky Picky not wanting to eat Puss Putty. And Puss Putty, by the way, kind of for a long time became my go-to way of describing any kind of like garbage food. When I was a kid, I would just use the term Puss Putty to mean like cheap knockoff food. That's what it was to me. Like, I didn't even have a cat. I didn't care about it. About pets, I didn't have a pet. But Puss Putty was just like, oh, that's what, you know, if you can't afford the real Cheerios, you're going to get the Puss Putty version of Cheerios.
Yeah.
And Beezus sort of takes up Picky Picky's, like, it's not that Beezus cares about Picky Picky more, but this is her way of expressing her dissatisfaction with the way she and Ramona are being treated. She won't just come out and say, I'm sick and tired of having to, like, give up everything in life. Because the Quimbys weren't well off in the first place. We know that. Like, it says that. Like, every once in a while, they had enough change left over to have a treat. But now they have to give up everything. And Beezus, rather than coming right out and saying, like, this stinks for both of us, this stinks for your kids, is sort of like becoming the advocate for the cat, saying, Picky Picky hates having to eat this cheap food. Picky Picky hates, Picky doesn't want to eat this Puss Putty. It's gross. And the father being like, well, then we'll just have to get rid of the cat. And being so, and it angers me, but it makes sense because Beezus is saying, like, isn't saying this for the benefit of the cat. She's saying it for the benefit of herself, her own emotional health. And when the father says, we'll just get rid of the cat, to a child, that's kind of saying, you better shape up or this could happen to you. Like, I don't know. Like, I like the fact that the parents are missing the needs of the children because that's very realistic, but it also makes me angry at the parents because they're missing the fact that their kids are asking for help.
I want to give a quick shout out here once again to Alan T. Green, because there's a picture of once Picky Picky has destroyed their jack-o'-lantern by chewing away most of one eye. There's a picture of him under the table with Ramona scolding him, and he is not an attractive cat.
No.
He's a disheveled, kind of mangy looking cat. He does not look at all ashamed at what he's done.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love the fact that he's not made to be in any way attractive. We had a cat that when I was young who was a well-loved cat, but by the time I was old enough to remember her, her name was Sally. She was pretty old and pretty fat. And she was kind of like lazed around the place, and then she hung on for much longer than one would expect a cat to hang on.
Yeah.
And she was kind of our Picky Picky, in that she would just show up, you know, in the middle of the night and meow angrily at something, and then disappear for another 2 or 3 weeks. And so,
I I do want to say, since you brought it up, T. Green's illustrations for this book obviously are amazing. He draws Ramona's father. I said mustachio. I don't remember why I thought he had a mustache, but he doesn't. There's an illustration of him picking the burrs out of Ramona's hair that's so well done, the way he draws Ramona's father. You can, and I mean this in the best way, you can smell the cigarette smoke. Like, if you grew up in the 1970s and the 80s, you know what this man smells like. He smells like aftershave. He smells like cigarettes. It's perfect. The way his hair is done, the look on his face, you know Ramona's father. Like, you understand who this man is. He's a blue-collar worker who had a lot of dreams. He had some kids. He's kind of having to give up a lot in his life. He loves his children. He doesn't have a lot of patience. He needs his cigarettes. I don't know. There's so much that T. Green captures in his illustrations that are just lost in later, like, as good as they may be, are lost in later illustrators. This is also where we get the introduction of Ramona's father's grandmother, who sounds like a horrible person, who everyone... He quotes these sayings, which you don't know if they were really the sayings of the grandmother or if Mr. Quimby is just making them up, but they usually result in threats of violence to children. Which is, I don't know, like, every time if I'm reading this out loud to Mitzi or we're listening to it and it gets to a quote from the grandmother, Mitzi gets very upset and very exasperated.
Now, I love these two. I agree that it's hard sometimes to tell whether these are meant in earnest or in jest. It reminds me of a conversation we've had several times before about how much fun it is to just completely antagonize and troll your own children.
Yes.
it's very easy to do. The trouble with childhood is you develop a desire not to be embarrassed by your parents at exactly the point the parents discover how much fun it is to embarrass their children.
Yes. He's not just embarrassing his children, he's threatening his children. Because, like, Ramona's trying to make jokes at the table to cheer her family up, and she's shot down by her father because she tells the joke three times. And the father says, "Ramona, as my grandmother used to say, like, first time is, like, funny, second time is silly, third time is a spanking." And he says this late, like, this time you're like, oh my goodness. He says the same thing later on, but as a real threat, like, to his children. And I'm like, man, come on, dude. Like, So this obviously is the chapter where they make a jack-o'-lantern and the jack-o'-lantern gets eaten by Picky Picky. I just want to throw out, this is another great example of Beverly Cleary really knowing how to set up a horror story, because Ramona hears Picky Picky eating the jack-o'-lantern in the middle of the night, and she thinks someone's broken into the house. And she just does a really good job at making this seem like a real, like, when you're a child and you hear something in the house in the middle of the night, like, just how scary that is. But also, there's another emotional confrontation between Beezus and the parents. And the parents actually get mad at Beezus, and Ramona cries. And the parents think it's about the jack-o'-lantern and not about what's actually happening in the family. And Mr. Quimby says, "We'll carve another jack-o'-lantern tomorrow, don't worry." And to me, the entire thesis of not just this book, but this entire series, is in the closing lines of this chapter, which is Ramona snuggled down with her dusty bear. Didn't grown-ups think children worried about anything but jack-o'-lanterns? Didn't they know children worried about grown-ups? And to me, that is Beverly Cleary just kind of laying it out bare. Like, that's what is happening in this book, is parents not understanding that children have a more complex emotional life than they give them credit for. And how that is kind of to the detriment of not only the children and the parents, but the family unit, is parents not understanding that these kids are worried and not taking that into account when they say things and do things and blow off their children's feelings.
No, definitely. And I think that it is the central thesis to this and to the Ramona and her mother book. I think that we'll get to what the Ramona and her mother, the flavor that's slightly different in that book when we discuss that. I think one of the things about this book is that again comes down to particularly gendered roles in the 1970s, that when the father was seen as the provider for the family, and that's his major role, is sort of the economic engine of the family. When that's taken away from him, part of what Ramona is trying to do in this book is she's trying to provide care for her father.
Yeah.
And his inability to realize this or to then to accept it is the conflict in the book. I mean, those moments where he finally allows himself to accept the whatever care Ramona can provide for him are the moments of triumph in this book.
Right. And I think that comes to a head. It really comes to a head in this next chapter, which is Ramona to the Rescue, where she is the chapter where she and Beezus form a united front to get their father to give up cigarettes. Because it all stems from what Beezus said in the previous chapter, which is basically, you know, we can't afford anything, but you can afford your cigarettes. And not only are you spending money on cigarettes, these are killing you and they're going to kill you. And it's hadn't occurred to Ramona before. The parents blow it off, but they begin this amazingly relentless campaign of getting their father to quit smoking by putting no smoking signs basically all over the house constantly, ultimately replacing his cigarettes with rolled up anti-smoking messages, which, you know, if you've ever dealt with a smoker, is kind of a dangerous grounds.
Yeah, I mean, this is another one of those things where we old people have to bore young people with our stories of it. It's hard to remember what life was like, I'd say, pre 1982 or so. People literally smoked everywhere in this country.
Yeah.
In every single restaurant you went into, in planes, in movie theaters. Everywhere. You just lived your life surrounded by cigarette smoke, and everywhere you went there were butts on the ground.
Yeah.
Now this is another chapter that resounds with me. My father growing up didn't smoke cigarettes. He smoked a pipe. I think he came up in that time when, you know, everyone wanted to be, I don't know, Reed Richards or something. There was a time in the 60s where smoking a pipe was seen as kind of classy, or I don't know. It marked you as a kind of a tweety intellectual. And I remember one time in the car breaking down and telling my dad I didn't want him to smoke anymore because I had learned that smoke was going to kill you.
Yeah.
And he did. He did stop smoking after that. And I'm glad he did, and he's still alive, and I probably listening to this podcast. But I do miss the smell of that pipe. I think it was a wonderful smell, as opposed to cigarettes, which I hate and are very, very bad, and please don't smoke cigarettes.
That's a message. Message from Click It Cast to you, listeners, please don't smoke cigarettes. We have learned that they're bad. But no, I agree. My father wasn't a smoker. I believe he smoked when he was in Vietnam, but he quit soon after. He did, because he would always make a point whenever anyone was trying to smoke of saying, quitting smoking is easy. I smoked for years, and then I decided not to, and I put down my cigarettes, and I never looked back. Like, that's just the kind of guy he is, which means because he did something that came simple to him, it obviously should be simple for everyone. And so whenever anyone was complaining about quitting smoking, he always thought it was just posturing. not lacked the ability to see through other people's eyes. But that's just one of his little fun little quirks. He is not listening to this podcast, by the way. But no, it was totally like someone not smoking was a big deal at the time. Like, and quitting smoking was a huge, like, everyone was kind of having to do it. Like, as the world got smaller and more places started eliminating access to smoking, people started quitting. And of course, the National Health Organization started making it more obvious, like, this is a bad thing. And then, of course, with secondhand smoke, it was even a worse thing. But obviously, these campaigns were going on in the 70s. And to tell a child, you know, like, what your parent is doing is slowly killing them, it's a huge deal. And this is, I think, of course, Ramona's first exposure to the notion that her parents aren't invulnerable. And so she takes it upon herself to get her father to quit. And he doesn't. But he is, even though Ramona isn't seeing him quitting, it's obviously having an effect on him, because there's this big ending of the chapter where Ramona accidentally gets locked out. Well, she gets locked out of the house because the father is basically getting, what is he getting?
His unemployment insurance.
Yeah. And he comes home late, and she finds out that he decides to try to quit smoking. And the first thing he does is he distracts himself from wanting a cigarette by engaging with his daughter, like really engaging with her for the first time in the book. They decide to do an art project, which is create the longest drawing in the world, the biggest picture in the world or whatever. And they decide to draw all of Oregon. And this is an amazing culmination of several things, because it's the moment where he really sits down and sees his daughter as an emotional person, like as an emotional, a person whose emotions are worthy of engaging with. Ramona is upset. He can't pretend anymore that she's just being a stupid kid. She is very worried about her father. It's also this sudden embrace of Oregon, which is something that I didn't understand as a child. I didn't know anything about Oregon, but it's this big celebration of their state. It firmly plants this entire book series in the state of Oregon. They have this wonderful thing where they create this incredibly long drawing on butcher paper. You really get involved and invested in her father as a creative person. You're like, oh, wow, he is a drawer. Like, he's an artist. Like, he loves to create. He loves to draw, and he's good at it. And Ramona's good at it. And you see them connect on this level. You haven't seen them connect before. And he promised. He's like, I will quit smoking. Like, I am going to quit smoking. I will do something. I will do my best to quit smoking.
I think interestingly, the next we talk about how the last bit with Christmas is sort of its own story. The next chapter on creative writing is also sort of its own thing.
Yeah,
in the middle of nowhere.
The tin can stilts.
Yeah,
Mrs. Swink.
Right. We're told what we've been told before. That Beezus has a difficulty with being creative. She doesn't trust her own imagination, and she doesn't like the idea of creative writing, of being creative. She just doesn't like this assignment she's been given. But it's an interesting thing. We get this moment where Beezus goes to interview an elderly woman, Mrs. Swink, for this writing assignment. And it seems, thematically, it seems kind of stuck in here, because it's Mrs. Swink talks about a simple joy of childhood that costs nothing to do.
Yeah.
And it's offered in this book in the way that, you know, quite frequently in children's books, I would love it whenever they would interrupt the story and give you a recipe for something.
Yeah.
Or they would tell you how to make, you know, there was that Curious George story that suddenly stopped the action to explain to you how to fold a paper boat.
Yes.
And I always thought that was like a big bonus when you were a kid. You would get like, oh, here's a project stuck into the middle of this book.
Right.
And why don't they do that for adult books today?
The only thing I think of, the original Scott Pilgrim graphic novel series, one of the stories stops dead in its tracks, and one of the characters turns to you and is like, I'm going to teach you how to make vegetarian
shepherd's pie.
Yeah, shepherd's pie.
Right. I remember
and
that.
I made that recipe. I was like, hot dog, this is perfect. I wish more books would do this.
Yeah.
But no, she teaches them how to make tin can stilts, which is a noisy but very fun activity for children.
Right, and how to yell pie face.
How to yell pie face.
Which I'm not exactly sure what it's supposed to mean.
I know that it's just an insult, and I know that pie face is actually a catchphrase in this book series that comes to a head in Ramona Forever. So be on the lookout for that. It is a word whose implications and reverberations will carry forward into the future and will result in a massive emotional confrontation a few books down the line. So pie face. this planting seeds, she is. So she and Howie make these stilts and challenge each other to seeing 99 bottles of beer on the wall all the way through, no matter how long it takes. And you have the wonderful thing where Beezus is embarrassed because the neighbors will think they're a bunch of beer guzzlers.
Right.
And
go ahead.
I was going to say, I forgot that, and this is true, though, and I had this with Mitzi. 99 Bottles of Beer on the Wall was a bit of a scandalous song for little kids to sing.
Right. That's charming. This book reminded me of what used to scandalize me as a child. This, as we will see when we get into the Christmas episode, and as we saw in the last episode or the last book, this series acknowledges religion in a way that Cleary has not acknowledged religion as a force in children's lives up till now. And it's charming, though, because it realizes that kids have a lot of interesting questions about the world around them, and they want to know what is or is not permissible, and it's not always that clear. I mean, one of the things one of the reasons why that smoking is such a big question is because just even today, when smoking is not allowed in public spaces, it is an interesting public health social issue when you're around people who smoke, and if you're like me, you would like to, on the one hand, believe in that people should be able to do what they want to do, whether it's bad for them or not. On the other hand, you would like to be free from smoke. And similarly here with these Ramona is walking up to the edges of propriety.
Uh-huh.
She's trying to figure out what, you know, there's a point here where she prays in the next chapter, and she's worried about whether her prayer is too trivial a matter for God to care about or not. I think that that this book just revels in complexity, and it doesn't really provide many answers, but it is also, again, written in a way that allows the grown-ups reading the book to their children to enjoy that the different perspectives that you have as an adult reading this than the children have, but it doesn't do anything at the expense of the children.
No. And I love that that the religion in these books, obviously the Quimbys are some denomination of Christian. They celebrate Christmas. Ramona prays to – there's not a whole lot of talk about Jesus until this book. It's that sort of understood acknowledgement that these people are religious. They may not go to church every Sunday, but they certainly go on Easter and Christmas. I guess they go enough that the kids have a relationship with the Sunday school, but it's just kind of a given. Like it's not a huge deal. These aren't religious books,
right?
But there is that transgression that you're talking about with the song, the 99 Bottles of Beer on the Wall song, Ramona calls Mrs. Swink Pie Face while she's on the stilts, and it gives her this like rush of power and this like sort of giddy sense that she has something that like a secret in joke with Mrs. Swink that's just hers and hers alone. And it's the first time she really genuinely feels free and has fun again since the beginning of this book. Also, the whole like Christmas thing. The first thing we see in the book is Ramona making a Christmas list in September. So that kind of bookends this book with Christmas, because this book ends right before Christmas with a Christmas pageant. A very 1970s Christmas pageant. I don't know. I don't know how familiar you are with the book, like the best Christmas pageant ever.
Oh, yes. I remember that book very well.
But yeah, it's that kind of Christmas pageant. Like, it's very busy. There's a lot of kids involved. There's a lot of jockeying for position as to who plays Mary, who plays Joseph, who plays the wise men. Like, there's a hierarchy of power, acknowledgement of who the better kids are, and also no one wants to play those roles. Like, it's basically the boys all jockeying for less and less prominence in the pageant, and the girls all jockeying for higher and higher prominence in the pageant, up to the three wise men in this one being played by all girls.
Right.
And I also want to say a little side tangent, just as far as the illustrations go. I grew up, the books that I grew up with were paperbacks, the Dell Yearling books that were illustrated by Alan T. Green, but the covers were painted by another illustrator whose name I can't remember. They were beautifully painted. Ramona and her father, Ramona and her mother. But the cover for this one is, and because we're getting into this final chapter, the cover for this one is it's Ramona in her sheep costume with her like coat and pants, her sheep hat and tail, holding her teddy bear with a jack-o'-lantern in her father's lap, picky at their feet, and her father like giving her this look like, And it's a really nicely done picture, but I realize now that it's basically like every incident from the book just kind of crammed into one illustration. Like, this doesn't happen in the book. Like, Ramona never confronts her father in a sheep costume while he's holding the jack-o'-lantern from Halloween, while picky sits at their feet. But it's kind of like they kind of try to encompass all the incident from the book in one illustration.
Right. You're referring to the painting by Joanne Scribner, is the name of the
yes.
If you look up Joanne Scribner on Google and do an image search, you'll find all of her. She had a really remarkable style that sort of reminds me of like a Saturday Evening Post style.
Yes,
it's not necessarily Norman Rockwell, but the guy who did all those Arrow shirt illustrations in the 30s or whatever. Now anyway, I'll think of it later. But yeah, she's a beautiful illustrations. She did the one for Ramona Quimby age eight. Which is just a portrait of Ramona. That's just a remarkable, remarkable.
She captures a look on Ramona's face that you're like, oh God, what is happening in this book? Ramona looks simultaneously terrified, tired, disappointed in everyone. Her illustration for Ramona the Brave is also wonderful, which is Ramona cowering under her covers. Her illustration for Ramona Forever is also remarkable. She just does some amazing paintings. I just wanted to point that out because we're barreling towards the end. The final two chapters of this book are one story, which is Ramona getting the idea that she should play a sheep in the Christmas pageant. It's never happened before, children playing sheep, but she doesn't want to be confined to the children's chorus. She promises that her mother can make a sheep costume. Of course, her mother cannot make a sheep costume because her mother does not have time to make a sheep costume. But Howie and Davy also get to be sheep, and they have plenty of access to people who will make their costumes. And now Ramona is suddenly faced with a problem that she's not going to have a good costume for her pageant, but she also is confronted with her father cheating on his cigarette giving up, And this is where she and her father kind of have a heart-to-heart. And I love this whole exchange where he's like, kid, this is really hard. Like things are really hard right now. And I found a cigarette and I smoked it and I'm really sorry. I'm trying my hardest. And she's like, I just want us to be a happy family. And he's like, dude, we are a happy family. Like, this is as good as it gets. This is as happy as things usually get for people. And he says, nobody's perfect. And all we can do is work at it. And we do. And that's kind of a nice little emotional end to their arc together. And then, of course, the last chapter is just a little adventure where Ramona comes to terms with the fact that she may not be the greatest sheep in the world, but she's still a sheep.
Right. I mean, there's two things that happen in this last bit here. Is one thing that's getting set up is the move into next book on the focus on the mother.
Yeah.
We get this glimpse into it right now that mom can't sew a sheep costume right now.
Right.
So go, you know, go do something else. But that's going to be an interesting. That I think that we'll talk about that next book. The what Ramona's modified view of her mother and her mother's role. But the other thing that happens here at the end is in some ways it's a typical. You mentioned the greatest Christmas pageant. There were a lot of these stories around this time. Even A Charlie Brown Christmas, which have the theme of. It's not important to be perfect. The most important thing is to show up and to be and to enjoy, and that's what, you know, Christmas is about. And yeah. There's something transformative about the moment of celebration that makes the imperfect into a perfect thing. And
yeah.
That's sort of what. And so, in some ways, it's a kind of a universal message, but it's particular to this book because it is putting into practice what she just. Talked about with her father, the moment that nothing is perfect, but it becomes perfect. There's a way in which life makes the things that are imperfect perfect.
Yeah, and it's, you know, as cheesy as it is, it's, you know, it's all said in this. Bees is cast as Mary, and Henry Huggins gets cast as Joseph.
Yes, is this the last we hear of Henry Huggins? I can't remember. If
we say that every book. Every book is this is the last of Henry Huggins, and he pops back up. He, in this book, we find out he's been trying to, like, break Guinness World Records, and he wants to be on the Olympics. Who knows? But this, of course, it's almost exactly like in the best Christmas pageant ever, because the main character gets to be on stage and reflect on her life as people are playing various important religious figures around her. And she sees that, like, Pisces is actually a lovely girl and who's a good sister, and maybe they fight a lot, but Beezus isn't mean, and that, you know, like, everyone's, it's that thing where, like, I'm in a Christmas pageant, and everyone's cool, and now everyone's just kind of being awesome, and everyone's singing songs, and Ramona's a sheep, and she's happy, and she's wearing makeup for the first time, because the three wise men put sheep makeup on her, and life ain't so bad. We find out that Dad has a job as a grocery store checker, and Things are looking up, and it's kind of like the end of Infinity War. Like, there's no real ending to this story. Stay tuned for the next, and we find out where things are going. I mean, that's all really happens is we're kind of like left. Her father is going to start a new job come New Year, and hopefully, fingers crossed, they'll be able to afford the decent food from now on.
Yeah, one thing I like about this is at the very end, Dad gets a job, and it's a job as a checkout in the checkout line at a supermarket. Today, of course, that would be that's not a job that would be able to you'd be able to run a family on.
No,
I think even less so now. Although, at the time of this book, at least, there's this dangled carrot of maybe someday he'll be able to manage a store.
Yeah,
and what I like about this is it's. There's no shame in work,
right?
I feel like in this book, and it's a disappointment in some ways, but it's also a relief in some ways, and that's that's a message I think that is good for adults as well as kids. And I think it's that Cleary treats her characters with enormous dignity.
Oh, no, definitely. And after all the events of this book, all the hand-wringing over food and money, and it is a relief for the reader to hear that the father has a job. It is nice that Cleary, that he wasn't like, I got a job as vice president of this. Like, it's, I don't even know what he was doing before. Like, all we know is that he was working for a small business. And I like that Cleary was like, he's been trying to get jobs. He's been going to interviews, and you sort of figure out that he's been going to interviews for jobs that aren't huge jobs. Like, it's just, he's just trying to get work. And and it's nice that it sort of leaves us dangling at the end. Like, will this help the family? I guess we'll have to wait till the next book to find out.
Yeah, I was a little surprised where, like I said, that the book ended where it ended. Uh-huh. It feels fine. It feels satisfying. It doesn't somehow feel like the end of an arc, because it isn't. And I don't think we actually hit the tonic chord, so to speak, uh-huh, until two more books. I think that's where it does end. And that's an interesting thing, you know, because I'm very used to in Cleary some moment of, we're going to encapsulate what this experience means to us.
Yes. And I like you said, we're not going to get that resolution for a while, which I respect, because that's life. But like, also that's childhood. That's things don't come to a nice conclusion. And Ramona, this is all about Ramona getting older and her perspective changing and her interior emotional life changing. And this whole like arc culminates in Ramona Quimby age 8, which is about her like sort of going through a year of her life and how she changes as a person. And so like, we're working through that. So she's come to some kind of terms with her father. Let's see next book if she comes to some kind of terms with her mother.
Yep. Well, stay tuned.
We'll get to it.
Eventually.
Yeah, we'll get to it. It's the next book. So, you know, hit subscribe, like and subscribe. Give us a review on iTunes.
One share equals two likes.
Oh, goodness.
Special thanks to this week's guest reader, Alana Gravitz.
You have been listening to Click It Cast, a Beverly Cleary podcast featuring Phil Gonzalez and John McCoy. Click It Cast is part of the Incomparable Network. To find out more about the Incomparable Network and the other podcasts it offers, visit incomparable.com. Smart, funny podcasts.